Alright, so the topic of the talk is fixing what's wrong with Bind. I should probably make it clear first that if you haven't read the abstract, the talk actually has very, very little to do with Bind. So, you know, if you're expecting me to talk about DJ DNS or something like that, you're going to be disappointed, and now is the time to escape. Anyway, so let's get rolling. So just a 3-second slide about me. My name's Michael Still. I come from Canberra. I mainly play with imaging code, but you know, I've done a little bit of kernel hacking and that kind of stuff. And I work for a Canberra software company. And let's not speak any more of it. And this talk is meant to be lighthearted. I don't know about you guys, but I've been here since Sunday. And so, you know, it's starting to feel like I've been here for a while. So I'm trying to be a little humorous in the talk, so you all have to like laugh and stuff, or I'm going to be really disappointed. I've actually scheduled 15 minutes for applause, just randomly spread through the talk, so if you could help me out. It has been suggested, if you'd like to make the sign and stand at the front, that'd be cool. Okay, so let's get on with the talk. Just quickly, if you have a question, ask it when you have it. You won't remember it at the end, and I won't remember what I've said, and I'll be trying to make a getaway by then, so feel free to interrupt, I suppose, by sticking up your hand or whatever. So let's get started. Most people would agree that Bind offers a DNS solution that is fast, unlike my laptop, scalable, secure, although people who haven't read the abstract keep coming up to me and saying that it's not really secure and I can fix that. So, you know, kind of secure at the very least. It runs on root servers, so it can't be that bad. And quite hard to configure well. There's an awful lot of LPI exam questions, for instance, on how to configure Bind. And you'd all absolutely have to agree that it's not written in Bourne Shell. Now, this talk is about fixing some of those problems. In fact, while we're at it, let's fix all of those problems. Okay, so this talk is about a DNS server I've written called Shitdiness. It's written in Bourne Shell, or Bourne Again Shell. It's inspired by Shazam, which is a shell assembler that's been floating around for a few years now. And obviously it's the most secure piece of software ever written, and your company needs Shell DNS. So go forth and buy it immediately. Okay, so what are we going to talk about during the talk? We'll talk about the design of Shell DNS. We'll talk about network sockets, because I learned some interesting stuff along the way. We'll talk about the DNS protocol so that we know how to parse it in order to, you know, return responses and stuff like that. I'll show you the code, just to prove that I did actually write something. Then I'll demo the code to prove that it does actually kind of, sort of work. And then we'll try and work out why I did it, because it seems like the last logical step. So, Shell DNS hangs off of inetd, as most, you know, shell scripts that do network stuff do, because inetd hands you stuff as it comes in. It dumps everything to a file, and there's a little script that dumps stuff to a file, and then another script that processes that file. And, you know, when you finish processing, you just spray your output to standard out, and magically it goes across the network to, you know, whoever made the DNS request. So it's all kind of magic, and it all just works, and it's all happy. I apologize, by the way, for the graphics. The projector is possessed by satanic forces. Or at least, that's how I thought it would work. Now, it turns out that it doesn't. And that made me very, very sad. It made me sad because I spent ages and ages and ages trying to work out why it didn't work. But we'll get there anyway. It turns out that I need something called a connected socket for this to work. So what's a connected socket? In fact, what's a connected socket and where do I get one from? Okay, well, at a more fundamental level, what's a socket? Well, a socket is just a data structure that describes your network connection. Now, the standard use of a socket is you ask the OS to create one for you. You then bind it to a given address and port that you want to listen on, and you can then accept connections with your socket. And for each connection, you probably do something interesting. otherwise it's a pretty dull server. So by default you get something called a disconnected socket. Now they're disconnected because they're not associated with any particular client. And that works just fine in TCP, for instance, because the packet says who, you know, the request came from. So here's a little C example of how to get yourself a disconnected socket. You create a socket with the socket call. You then do a bunch of stuff to initialize, you know, what address you want to listen on, what port, which is the, you know, serve address stuff there. You then bind to that address, and if somebody's already listening there, you'll get an error. And then you can just forever go around in a loop, grabbing data that comes in, doing some stuff and responding. Receive from will block until data is available. So it'll just sit on the receive from line until a packet has come in. So to use these sockets, you use the receive from and send to calls. Now that's fair enough, unless your language doesn't have receive from and send to. Now shell only has read and write, so obviously this isn't going to work for me. For those you need a connected socket, because a connected socket is associated with a particular client, so a read implicitly reads from them and a write implicitly writes to them. So what is a connected socket? Well, the terse response is a connected socket is the socket that's had the connect call called on it. And that's the first little bit of the man page. The file's descriptor, socfd, must refer to a socket. If the socket is of type soc datagram, which it is in UDP, then the serve address is the address to which the datagrams are sent by default, and the only address from which datagrams are received. So you're tied to a specific client somewhere out there in networking there. So here's an example in C of how to get yourself a connected socket. Now I've skipped the boring setup stuff that's the same. So what you do is inside the bit that waits for some data, you do a receive from still. So we're cheating a little. And that just peeks at the data. So it doesn't take the data off the network stack, it just has a quick look at it. We use that to grab the address that the connection came from. We can then connect to that address. And then we can just use read and write, which is down the bottom of the screen, to do our networky stuff. So there's a little bit of cheating. You still need one receive from call. So why am I telling you all of this? Well, I developed shell DNS against INETV, as given to me by Debian in their wisdom. And it doesn't implement a connected sockets for UDP traffic. So I wrote this cool script that did DNS-y kind of stuff, and I tested it by grabbing a DNS request with netcat and having it on a file on a disk, and I'd, you know, push it through standard in, and, you know, I'd get some binary back that looked kind of right, so I was pretty happy. And then I hooked it up to INETV, and it didn't work. Like, completely didn't work. It looked like my script was never getting any input. And, like I said earlier, that made me very sad. Now, it made me sad because it took ages to work out what was happening. In fact, I ended up getting the response by giving an earlier version of this talk in Canberra, and Tridge was at the back of the room, and he stuck his hand up and said, well, you're a muggins, you need a connected socket. So clearly the moral is to complain as much as humanly possible near Tridge. And then you also need to go home immediately and apply this patch to your INETV. You should just trust me that it works. Now, all the patch does is do exactly what that example before did. It waits for some data to come in, it peeks at the data, which is kind of in the middle of the screen, it connects to that address, and then it goes off and runs your script. Now, that patch is generated against whatever Debian Unstable gave me in January 2003 looking at it. But I can't imagine it's changed an awful lot. In fact, the live CD that you had in your conference bag comes with a hacked version of INETD that will work with shell DNS, which is also on the CD. But we'll get there later. I know this slide looks the same, it's because it's too long. It turns out that XINETD doesn't have this problem. They give you a connected socket for UDP. So if you're using XINETD, then you can ignore the patch and you'll be happy. So now we have a patch INETD, so we can run a UDP shell script. We probably need to know a little bit about the DNS protocol if we're going to make this work. So this is what a DNS request looks like. Again, I apologize for the weird shadow effect. So you get an identification for the request. Now that's just going to be a number that you hand back so the client knows what you're responding to. You get a bunch of flags, which we'll talk about in a second. There's a number of questions, answers, authorities, and additionals. So for a standard request, it'll just be one question and zero for the others. And then you get the questions, answers, additionals, authorities, and additionals. So that doesn't look too hard to parse into shell script. And we get some flags. We get whether or not it's a query or a response. We get the opcode. We get whether or not we want an authoritative answer in the request, and then whether or not it is an authoritative answer in the reply. We get whether or not the answer was truncated. UDP packets max out at 512 bytes, so if you're doing something like a zone transfer, that's almost certainly going to be bigger than that. You're going to need to use TCP for that. Shell DNS only does UDP, so don't do your zone transfers with my shell script. Yeah, it is possible also that you'll ask for who is www.ibm.com and get a 37 IP addresses or something. Whether or not recursion is desired, whether or not recursion was available, and whether or not there was an error. So, for instance, zero is no error, and the standard no such domain that you get back if you look up something that doesn't exist is just error code 3. So what does a query look like? Well, a query is just that question there I talked about before, right? So you get the name that you're looking for, which is interesting because it's not padded out to a 32-bit boundary like the rest of the packet. You get the type, which is one of those from the list. And you get the class. The only class I care about is internet, so it will always be one. So there's some types there, IP address, name, server, I want the mail exchanger, that kind of thing. There are some other types that I've never actually needed to use, but you know, the Windows people seem to care about the authenticated DNS kind of stuff. And then finally there's some zone transfer types and stuff like that. There's about 20 types in all. Shell DNS only does a query, so it will only return an IP address when you hand it a name. So what does the name look like in the query? Well, you have a byte that tells you how many characters are about to appear. You have the characters, then another byte and some more characters, then another byte and some more characters, right? So for instance, for www.stillhq.com, you'll have the number three and then three W's, for instance. And it's just terminated with the zero. So still, I haven't found anything that looks particularly hard to parse into shell. So what does an answer look like? Well, in an answer, you hand back the name that was asked for. You hand back the type and the class that they'd asked for, because it's possible, because UDP is connectionless, for the client to have more than one request outstanding. So they need something to tie it back. You have a time to live. Now, shell DNS is a little bit dodgy, so I always set that to like a second. You have a resource data length. Now, because I'm always returning an IP address, it will always be 4 for the 4 octets in an IPv4 IP address. And the resource data, which in my case will just be the IP address. So here's an example request. The identifier is 2A2A, which is just an arbitrary number that you hand straight back. It has no flags, so it's going to be a standard query. It doesn't want an authoritative answer. It doesn't want to truncate. Well, in fact, sorry, this packet isn't truncated, and it doesn't care about recursion. It's a request for an IP address. Oh, sorry. First, the number of questions is 1. The number of answers, additionals, and authorities is 0. It's a request for an IP address in the internet. Then it gives you the name, the query class. No, sorry. Yeah, then it gives you the name. So here's a sample response. So we hand back their ID number. We twiddle the flag that says, hi, I'm a response. So the flags field's changed. We now have 1 answer and no questions, additionals, authorities, whatever. In fact, looking at it, that's wrong. I believe we returned the question as well. So the question field should be 1. The name that we were answering for, the time to live, the size of the answer, and the answer. So now we know how to hack INETZ to make our shell script work with UDP, and we know enough about the DNS protocol to be dangerous. So let's have a look at the code. Now, first of all, there's that wrapper script I talked about that takes the data that's handed to it and just whacks it in a temporary file. Now, the reason I need to do that is because INETZ just hands it to me as it arrives. So, you know, for instance, you can't guarantee that byte 4 is present yet, and if it's in a temporary file, then it gives me something to spin on until byte 4 is available. And then it just fires up the processing script. Now, the processing script has a bunch of boring helper functions we have to wade through, but they're actually the most interesting bit because they're the bits that twiddle binary and stuff and the bits that actually do things. The bit that actually builds an answer is probably the most boring bit. So we're going to wade through some of those. So the first one is dump bit. Now, dump bit just takes a byte and an offset into that byte expressed as a power of 2. So for instance, 8 or 16 or 32. Now, it prints out if the value of that bit is on, and it returns the byte without that bit on. So for instance, if you pass in 42 and 2, it will print out 1 because the 2 bit is on, and return 40, so 40 without the 2 bit on. Now, test bit just munges that and returns whether or not the bit was on. Twiddle bit is used to flick bits in a byte. So it takes the byte, it takes the insert, again as a power of 2, and it takes the new value that you want for the bit. So for instance, you'd pass it, you know, 42 to 0, and it would return 40 because you've asked for the 2-bit to be flipped 12. And it's not all that scary in shell land. Spin 4 is going to spin on a byte in the temporary file. As I said before, you know, byte 4 might not be available yet, so what you do is you hand it a file name and the byte that you're after, and it repeatedly tests the length of the file until it's at least that big, and if it's not, then it just sleeps for an arbitrarily small amount of time. Which is, on a side note, that's kind of cool, right? Yeah? Yeah. Yes, the entire UDP request, the entire request arrives in 1 UDP packet, and I thought it would be cool too, but when I was writing it, I'd find that INETD hadn't got around to writing my data to the temporary file yet, or my script hadn't, or whatever, so I did actually hit a scenario where bytes weren't available yet, so I actually went back and added all of this in. So I guess it's mainly because I've got a shell script that's taking data and whacking it into a temporary file, and if that hasn't done the whacking bit yet, and I'm asking for some data on the enemy account. The other bit is you have to have a temporary file because in the answer you return the name that they asked for, so you need to be able to go backwards in the stream to grab the stuff, unless you're going to go in a stack bit somewhere. Sorry, Yes, the cool bit is the way the spinning is implemented is a bit ham-fisted. So, you know, it's quite easy to see a box sitting there with a load average of 2 or 3 spinning, waiting for data to come in. So, you know, I wouldn't run this on a real machine. Okay, read a byte, just takes a file name, the byte you want, waits for the byte to be present, and then spews it back. Read a string, pulls out a range of bytes, having determined that they are actually present first. So, for instance, the stillhq bit in the name, I know that I want 7 bytes, I know where they start. So I can say, hey, look, you know, just hand me back that when it's ready. Now, how's that for a pipeline? Okay, this reads a binary byte and returns it as a decimal number. There's only, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 processes to do it. Not including any spinning that may be required. Okay, write binary bit. Takes a byte and the power of 2 to check, and prints the bit value of that power of 2. So it's a little bit like some of the ones we used earlier. Write binary bytes. Just prints out a binary representation of a byte that you handed it. It was helpful for debugging, among other things. Ah, yes. This is probably my personal favorite. Now, Echo can output random binary characters if you ask nicely, but the catch is that it only takes octal. So the vast majority of this function takes your decimal number that you want to print out as binary and turns it into octal. Okay, now we're on to processing the request, which is, you know, fairly mechanical once we've got all the interesting bits. So we pull out the identification of the request, then we log it and all that. We pull out the flags so we know whether or not it's a request and that kind of stuff. We pull out the number of questions that have been asked. We also did the same for answers, authorities and additionals, just because they're there. And then for each question. So at this point we know that there is a question in the packet. We know where that question starts. So we can now parse that question. So we go through and we read the name that you're asking for, which is what that loop in the middle does. Whips around until it gets to a byte that says I have no more bytes in the name. We can then get the type of the request, and we said before that we only do 8 queries. And we can get the class of the request, which should always be 1, which means the internet. Ah, yes. If we don't have an error, then we can continue. So if you ask for, you know, an MX record, then I'm going to have to flag that as an error and refuse to answer. And so now we can build a response. So we spray back the ID number that you handed us. We flag this packet as being a reply, so we twiddle the reply bit. If it was an error, for instance, the lookup failed, then we say it's an error. Sorry, I skipped a bit on the last slide. Yeah, sorry, the bit at the bottom, I should have discussed. And then we look up the name in our little lookup file, which is just a text file with 2 columns delimited by tab. So we do a grep and we say, you know, they asked for www.stillhq.com, is it there? If we've got no lines back, then we flag that as an error. Because we need that on the slide I was just talking about, because the packet looks different if it was erroneous. the errors flag will be on. The number of questions that we're responding to, the number of answers that we have, and authorities and additionals are always zero because we don't implement them. And then we return the question, which isn't too bad because, you know, we just copy a bunch of slides. And then we have the answer bit that we whack on only if the lookup was successful. So, yep, just copy the type and the class and the name. Time to live is 4 seconds. Just copy the script, so nice and low. The length to return data, which is always 4 octets for an IP address, the IP address. And then, probably makes it unreadable. And now we just send result back. All of the processing we've done to generate output has gone to a temporary file again. The reason I do that is because if you hand inetd a byte, it tends it. There's no buffering. So you've got to build it all up into one big blob of data and then push it all out at one write, or otherwise they'll get a corrupt packet at the other end. And then we can, you know, log that we're finished processing. This is just the entry point, so it just says, you know, I'm at the start of that temporary file and I'm going to, you know, process stuff until I run out of stuff to process. No, nobody else is allowed to run cat on the box. No, there are many other much bigger problems than killing everybody's cat. We should have a demo. Can people read an X term that small? Cool. No? What button do I click again? Right click? With shift or something. Oh, there we go. Huge. Cool. Can you read that? Cool. I actually need a couple of those. Show you the logging that it does. I'll leave that sitting in the background. So if you look at your live CD, you too will have a directory called userlocal/shell/dns. Now to start shell/dns, use the start script, which is a little scary. If you have an inetd running that you're particularly fond of, it's not there anymore. And then we're going to run Michael's amazing hack to inetd. Now, it's not actually a big deal. I was surprised when I handed the code to Ben Kira, who built the LiveCD. It turns out Nopix doesn't run inetd by default, so I'm probably not killing anything that you know particularly care about. And then there's a stop script that just kills off, you know, any random processes that I might have floating around. Okay, so if we start up the... So it's now started. Now, the box doesn't have localhost as the default name server. I've been reading email and stuff. But if you append onto your host command the IP address of the DNS server, then it will just use localhost, right? So, in this world, foo.stillhq.com resolves to localhost. And you can see that a bunch of log stuff was written out. Now, so what about bar.stillhq.com? No such domain. Or no such name, sorry. And if we look at the lookup file, we can see that that's right. There's only an entry for foo. So it does really work, see? Cool. I think I meant to be wrapping up, so I'll just flip back across. 10 minutes? Cool. Does that include the question time? Okay. So why did I do this? Well, the short answer is it was kind of towards the end of my honours project, and I was a little bit tense, and I needed something that didn't matter. And I had a copy of W. Richard Stevens, you know, to CPIP Illustrated Volume 1 next to me, and I thought, hey, I'll implement an RFC in Shell. It actually got a bit bigger than that. It turned out when I started doing it that I couldn't find any documentation for how to do UDP with INET. There was an occasional post from someone saying they were having troubles, but there was basically no doc about it. So I figured that, hey, learning how to do this is at least vaguely useful. So I'm hoping the conference paper, which describes, you know, why you need connected sockets and all that kind of jazz, might be helpful to someone in the future who has something more meaningful to do than write DNS servers. So why is UDP sometimes the right solution? You know, there are people out there who might want to write a UDP server. Well, UDP is connectionless, right? So with a TCP connection, that is a connection, the client sends us in, the server sends us in ACK, and then the client sends an ACK. Now what that means is that before you can even really start talking, there's a complete round trip. Now it's not 1.5 round trips because you can send your first bit of data with your ACK. But that's still a delay that, you know, if you just want to, I don't know, you've got, you know, a little toy robot that you're controlling or whatever and you just want it to turn now, if it hasn't happened quickly, you don't really care anymore. It's crashed. So for solutions where, you know, the data is timely or it's unimportant, then UDP is the right answer. Yes. In scenarios where you really, really care about having the worst DNS server possible, then yes, UDP is the right solution too. So you might want to use UDP in scenarios where you care about timing. It's also lightweight compared with TCP. So, you know, I think, for instance, syslog has a UDP option. I've run out of stuff to talk about. So, you know, because you guys failed to applaud for 10 minutes. So, questions? Yeah? I wasn't really intending there to be a version 2, but I'm happy for you to fork the code base. Yeah? I haven't submitted any of my stuff to Slashdot. That would be cheating. So if you would like to, yeah. No, last time I got Slashdotted, the server sustained 10 megabit outgoing. I don't think this would be capable. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not clear on who Upstream is. Like, I'm a Debian user, not a Debian developer, right? Talking to Dan Shearer when he was building the live CD, and we were trying to decide what version of NetKit he had so I could build a patch for him. Kind of looks like NetKit was something that was stolen from the BSDs in the mid-90s and is now done by Debian. So, Debian still runs INET by default, or at least it does on my box. Okay. No, because I haven't learned how to do that yet, but I will. But people have survived this long without the patch, so maybe, you know, they can just Google if they need it. But if Debian's going to XINFD, then it's irrelevant anyway. Yeah. Well, Samba, for instance, can run out of INFD, right? The difference is that they're written in languages that can call the connection call themselves. My problem is that my chosen language for this problem couldn't. So I need INFD to hold my hand. And it must be a common enough scenario that, you know, XINFD already did it. Like, I expected to have to write a patch for that, but it's already there. Yeah? No, not particularly. I think recursion could be pretty scary. Like, if you've got a really, really busy box, and then some guy pops on in and says, "Hi, I just want you to recursively query to infinity and beyond," then I'd probably be worried about how much work my box was going to be doing. Yeah, because otherwise I'm going to recurse 20 million requests at you. I think that's probably the scariest bit. It's pretty cool because you can plug extra stuff in. Like there's, what, 230 available free times that Microsoft will use for weird things, I assume. Yeah? Any other takers? I reckon if you looked up for a name with the backtick in it, then that could be pretty cool. This still runs as root, or at least it does on my laptop, and it's still running. You'd have to be pretty keen to run this in the real world, I think. Yeah. No. That'd be really cool if you're a hosting provider or something too. Okay, cool. I guess that means you get an early mark, okay. Is it written in Shell? It doesn't meet my requirements to use the Okay, cool. Yes, Netcat rocks, by the way. I love my Netcat. Cool. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, everybody.